Have I mentioned before that my home state of Kansas is hot in the summer? And please understand, I'm not talking about some kind of relative to something else hot. It's flat-out blistering hot. It's dangerous hot, as in health warnings on the radio hot. Over 100 degrees was often the norm, with 110 not entirely uncommon, and a day of high 80s to low 90s ranking as cooler temperatures on the forecast. This was the cauldron in which much of my childhood each year developed. Of course, as kids, we found ways to try and stay cool. During extreme temperatures, it was indoor activities in front of the window air conditioning unit. Also, the town swimming pool was a popular destination for many, though not so much so for me. I was never much of a social sort. Far and away, the thing my friends and I did most to relieve ourselves of heat and boredom was to head for the Smoky Hill River, which bordered the south side of town. With our bows and arrows in hand, ready to slay as many carp as we could find and drive our arrows into. Welcome to Bristol Bay Field Notes. I'm Terry Fuller, Education Specialist for Togiak National Wildlife Refuge. Today's episode isn't about bow fishing, an activity I really miss participating in. For those who know nothing about it, with bow fishing you have a reel attached to your bow with the string attached to the arrow, and you reel in the fish after you shoot it. The arrow has a special barbed tip that keeps it from coming out of the fish. People bowfish for anything from small suckers to large sharks, at least in states where bowfishing is legal. Compared to other states, Alaska has very limited bowfishing opportunities. So no, today's episode is not about bowfishing. It's not about carp either, though now we're getting closer to the topic. There are no carp in Alaska that I'm aware of, and that's probably a good thing. Kansas is littered with them, and they seem to find their way into every conceivable type water body. Carp are not a native species to North America. They are an Asian species. They were introduced into the United States by our government, ironically, in the 1800s in hopes that they would take off as a food fish, which they largely have not. Because they are not native and have completely taken over so many aquatic ecosystems across our continent, carp are one of our biggest examples of an invasive species. I don't know what you know about invasive species, but they're a pretty hot topic at many other refuges throughout the refuge system. While we do have invasive species in Alaska, they haven't yet become quite the big issue that they are across much of the lower 48. According to Presidential Executive Order 13112, an invasive species is defined as a species that, number one, is non-native to the ecosystem under consideration and, number two, whose introduction causes or is likely to cause economic or environmental harm or harm to human health. In other words, something that wasn't there and shouldn't be there but is and could likely cause some very major problems. Non-native species become invasive when they are introduced into and flourish in a new environment. This happens when the normal biological mechanisms are lacking in that new environment but did exist in their previous environment, such as natural predators or diseases. Without those natural checks in place, invasive species often run rampant in their new environment, to the detriment of the natural biodiversity of an area. This can threaten native species and often cause large-scale financial damage to local economics. According to one website I saw, approximately 50,000 non-native species have been introduced into the United States. This can happen in a number of ways, from human movement to intentional introduction for a perceived benefit to society, kind of like those carp I mentioned, to turning loose the family pet. Not all species go Mother Nature's version of viral, though. Some simply cannot survive outside their native environment. For example, Kansas at times has stocked rainbow trout and pike in some of its waters as a new sport fish, but water temperatures during breeding seasons are too warm for those species to reproduce. Still other species thrive in new places, but wind up having no known adverse effects to their new ecosystem. So not every new species winds up an invasive. No, it's the ones that have a bad effect that get that label. Again, species that contribute negative effects on the ecosystem or adverse impacts to the economy or human health are tagged as invasives. And what damage do they do? Invasive species can alter ecosystems by causing change to habitat composition or an increase of wildfire risk. One way many species become harmful is through competing with native species for food and territory, or causing a change to existing predator-prey relationships. When any of this happens, it becomes a tremendous threat to established biological diversity. Again, the list of invasives to Alaska is smaller than many other places, but a list does exist. Some species you might see on that list include Atlantic salmon, Chinese mitten crabs, European green crabs, European starlings, gypsy moths, New Zealand mud snails, northern pike, Norway rats, red-legged frogs, rock doves, and zebra mussels, to name just a few. And those are just some of the animal species. There are also dozens of invasive plant species out there as well. Some of the animal species I just mentioned you may have heard of. Others perhaps not. Some may come as a surprise, such as pike. Fact is, pike are a native species across much of our state, including southwest Alaska. However, they are not native south and east of the Alaska Range, essentially south-central Alaska. Pike are highly predatory and often the top-level predator in the ecosystems in which they're found. The problem with pike in south-central Alaska is that pike have taken over waters that accentuate their ability to hunt while providing them with native species that do not have adaptations in place to deal with getting away from pike. The result is that pike in this part of the state are now having a huge detrimental impact on specific salmon and trout populations. You can imagine how much this concerns subsistence and sport anglers in these areas. And once pike are established in an area, they can be mighty tough to eradicate. So, how did these pike get into South Central waters? It is believed that back in the 1950s, some folks thought it would be cool to have pike to catch and imported them in from other areas. Because of the threat they now pose to salmon and trout, pike in South Central Alaska are an invasive species. Closer to home, around the Bristol Bay region or the Togiak Refuge area, we really don't have much in the way of invasives. In that way, we continue to be blessed. But because the world around us is becoming increasingly smaller each and every year, it's something we need to continue to be on guard against. For example, one of the animals on that list is the New Zealand mud snail. There are currently no known instances of these snails in our state. So what's the big deal? Let me draw you something of a picture. New Zealand mud snails are awfully small, as in an eighth of an inch is a large one. They can be much smaller. They can survive in all types of water, from really warm to freezing and from clear to pretty muddy. They reproduce asexually. For those that don't remember high school biology, that means it only takes one. And they live in huge colonies, with as many as a half million per square yard. So just why are these very small organisms such a bane to water systems, you ask? It's the domino effect. They eat small insects and insect larvae, normally targeted by juvenile trout and salmon in aquatic ecosystems. Because mud snails are found in such huge concentrations, they consume large amounts of the available food these juvenile salmon and trout would eat. As a result, trout and salmon populations across some parts of the lower 48 have experienced dramatic declines in recent years. On the surface, an eighth-inch-long snail doesn't sound so bad, does it? Until we let ourselves consider salmon populations around Bristol Bay declining. Hopefully, that brings it home kind of strong. For what it's worth, New Zealand mud snails were first discovered in the United States in 1987 in Idaho. They have since spread rapidly across the western United States. They can pass through a trout's digestive tract alive and intact, survive 24 hours without water entirely, and also survive up to 50 days on a simple damp surface. It was found in the lower 48 that one of the ways these snails traveled between water systems was through felt sole waders. Other small harmful invasives can also travel via felt sole waders. As a result, felt sole waders are now illegal for use for hunting or fishing in fresh waters in Alaska. If you did not know that already, perhaps it's time to hang up your felt soles, permanently, and get online to find some that have a hard sole to them. Perhaps with a bit of vigilance on the part of everyone, we can keep invasives at bay in the years to come, at least where our corner of the world is concerned. No doubt, the world is always changing. Still, we should make every effort we can to safeguard those resources that are important to us. For Field Notes, I'm Terry Fuller. Music from Loon Echo Lake, provided courtesy of Solitudes at www.solitudes.com.